score, Captain McClanahan," he assured Brad. "No one, especially not some Fed, is going to mess with her on Texas soil. I promise you that."
"I'm not leaving,"
a firm, matter-of-fact voice said. It was Patrick McClanahan. He stared hard at Martindale. "We've been running from Stacy Ann Barbeau for too long. It's high time we stopped hiding out and took a stand. The American people need to know what she's done, and what she's failed to do." Martindale snorted. "And just what over-optimistic impulse leads you to conclude that Barbeau will ever give us that chance, General? Before we can say boo, she'll have her goons drag us off to some black site, about as far away from the media as the backside of the moon."
"I wouldn't be too sure of that,"
Farrell said with a sudden flash of teeth in the darkness.
"Y'all may have forgotten, but those Russians were trying to kill me, which makes this a matter for the state of Texas, not the federal government."
Martindale stirred. "I suspect the president will strongly dispute your jurisdiction, Governor." Farrell shrugged again.
"Sure she will," he agreed. "But it'll make a real dandy court case, won't it?
And it would be one hell of a media draw, especially coming smack dab in the middle of a hotly contested presidential campaign." Despite his sadness and anxiety for Nadia, Brad felt a sudden urge to laugh at the bemused expression on Martindale's face. It appeared that the master manipulator might finally have met his match. The staccato chatter of submachine guns rang out, echoing off the high ground to the south. Brad spun toward the sound of the firing and darted off at full speed, slowing down only long enough to scoop up an object off the ground with his CID's still working left hand. Near the Farrell Ranch, that same time. Nikolai Dubrunin frowned toward the Farrell Ranch. The sound of firing from over those hills had ended several minutes ago. So where were Borushev and his damned KVMs? The longer they delayed here, the more likely they would be to run into American law enforcement or military roadblocks on the roads back to San Antonio, and then farther south toward the U.S.-Mexican border.
"Spectre lead, this is Checkmate 2," he said into his throat mic. "Do you read me? Over."
There was no reply, only the hiss of static over an empty frequency.
"What kind of game are those bloodthirsty maniacs playing now?"
he groused to Pavel Erianov. The larger man shrugged.
"It's probably better if we don't know," he advised. "If we want to be able to sleep tonight, that is."
Dubrunin winced. That much was probably true, he decided. He'd already had nightmares about the blood and scraps of human flesh, coating Barushev's war robot after that attack out in California. He tapped Larionov on the shoulder.
"Let's put the rest of our guys in, Pavel. I want to get on the road as soon as the colonel and the others return."
The other man nodded. He turned his head toward where the other three former Spetsnaz soldiers were posted and spoke briefly into his own mic, using their team's own secure channel. One after another, Yumashev, Popov, and Mitkin rose from their concealed firing positions along the dirt road and trotted back toward the three parked big rigs. Finished, Larionov asked,
"What about the captain?"
Dubrunin sighed.
"If Kirill's smart, he'll hold tight. He's got a good position.
Once the Americans make their initial sweep, he might be able to get clear and make it out on his own." The big man snorted.
"You really believe that bullshit, sir?"
"Not really," Dubrunin admitted. "But let's face it, the captain was fucked as soon as Moskva sent that premature attack order."
He shook his head.
"We just have to hope that he keeps his mouth shut long enough for the rest of us to escape."
Larionov's head, hit by a 7.62mm bullet, exploded in Dubrunin's face, spraying him with lacerating fragments of bone and teeth. The big man went down in a boneless heap, like a puppet with all its strings cut. For a split second, Dubrunin stared down at the dead man in open-mouthed astonishment. Then he recovered.
"Sniper!"
he yelled, diving for the ground. Along the road, Mitkin and Yumashev reacted fast, hitting the dirt and rolling into a shallow ditch beside the road. Popov was slower, fatally so. A second silenced rifle shot dropped him in his tracks.
"Suppressive fire!"
Dubrunin shouted.
At the hillside, across the road!
They opened up with their HK-7s, firing short bursts toward the opposite slope, carefully directing their shots at the most likely spots where the unseen sniper could be hiding. Dust, bits of torn brush, and sparks from ricochets drifted downwind.
Cease fire!
Dobrunin called.
Cease fire!
Silence descended across the darkened stretch of Texas country road.
Did we get him?
He heard Mitkin ask. Another rifle bullet tore up the dirt beside Dobrunin's face. Frantically, he rolled away and scrambled into cover behind a big rig truck tire.
Unfortunately not,
he said dryly. He grimaced. They were pinned down. Advancing into the open against that concealed rifleman would be suicide. The same thing applied to trying to drive away down the road in their trucks. No, he thought angrily. They were stuck until Borushev's KVMs returned, pinpointed the solitary sniper who'd ambushed them, and blew him away.
Where the hell are those robots?
He wondered aloud. Right here, he heard an ice-cold electronic voice reply. Dobrunin whipped around in time to see a massive shape emerge out of the darkness. Relieved, he stood up, careful to keep the tractor tire between him and the rifleman who'd killed Larionov and Popov.
It's about fucking time, he growled,
and then felt the hairs on the back of his neck stand up when the robot moved closer. It was taller than the KVMs, with a six-sided head.
Oh, Christ, he muttered.
You're not one of ours, are you?
The Iron Wolf war machine shook its head. No, I'm not. It tossed an object on the ground. Dobrunin stared down in horror at the smooth, featureless ovoid that rolled up against his boots. That's what's left of your robots, the CID said harshly. Now it's your turn. Surrender, or die. It's your call. Numbly, Dobrunin tossed his submachine gun aside and raised his hands. He heard the clatter of weapons hitting the ground as Yumashev and Mitkim followed his example. On the Farrell Ranch, a short time later, Kirill Aristov decided it was time to go. So far, only a single medevac helicopter had landed and taken off, but he could hear more aircraft in the distance, along with the sound of police and fire engine sirens coming closer. If he waited much longer, the ranch would be swarming with American police and soldiers, and there was no way he could evade a serious sweep by dismounted troops and sheriffs with dogs. From his vantage point on this low, wooded knoll, it was difficult to know exactly what had happened, but one thing was very clear. Borushev's attack had run into ferocious and wholly unexpected opposition. He'd seen the last of the KVMs destroyed, blown to pieces near the top of the hill across from him, and he'd watched another vanish into the darkness beyond the burning ruins of Farrell's ranch house, followed soon after by a powerful explosion. That, coupled with the sight of one of those Iron Wolf war machines moving out in the open without being fired on, strongly suggested the colonel and his men had been defeated. But whether they'd won or lost no longer mattered much to Aristov. His only goal now was to get off this ranch and out of the country as fast as possible. With that in mind, he carefully stowed his night vision camera and scope back inside his camouflage suit. Then slowly and cautiously, he wriggled backward, out from between the two gnarled trees he'd been using for cover. As soon as he reached a place where brush and high grass cut off his view of the burning house, he started to get up, and froze suddenly, feeling the cold muzzle of a gun at the base of his skull.
I'd sure appreciate if you'd keep your hands where I can see them, an amused-sounding voice drawled conversationally. See, I'm a little high-strung just now, and my trigger finger gets kind of twitchy when that happens.
Aristov swallowed hard. He lowered himself back down and carefully spread his hands out, palms flat against the ground. He lay still while the gunman patted him down roughly but efficiently, swiftly finding and removing his camera and his fighting knife, which was the only weapon he carried. The gunman stepped back.
You can roll over now, friend.
Aristov did as he was told, and saw a grizzled, tough-looking man pointing a Ruger Mini-14 ranch rifle at him. The American wore a camouflage suit much like his own.
You have the advantage on me, mister.
The other man nodded politely,
The name's Davis. Andrew Davis.
Aristov sighed. And how long have you been watching me, Mr. Davis?
Pretty much from the time you crossed Governor Farrell's property line, the American said casually.
So, what happens now?
Davis grinned back at him.
We mosey on down to what's left of the governor's house.
His eyes hardened.
I sure hope you didn't have any real urgent business, friend. Like, say, down in Mexico, or maybe back home in Russia. Because I'm thinking there are an awful lot of folks who are real eager to have a word or two with you.
44. The Kremlin, Moscow. A short time later. Vladimir Kuraykin sat in painful silence, watching the evidence of an unmitigated disaster unfold in real time. The big-screen monitor in Grislov's private office currently showed a hurriedly called press conference taking place at Governor John D. Farrell's Texas ranch. The American presidential candidate stood confidently before an array of microphones, looking tired but otherwise none the worse for wear.
These terrorist attacks against our military and our vital defense industries and scientists, and now against me, were carried out by Russian mercenaries. Mercenaries, I'm convinced, were acting on the orders of the Russian government itself. Fortunately, thanks to the heroism and incredible self-sacrifice of a handful of brave American patriots and their Polish comrades in arms, this threat to our country and to our political stability was stopped cold tonight.
Farrell's mouth tightened.
Despite President Barbeau's earlier repeated assertions otherwise, the evidence of Moscow's involvement in those atrocities is now overwhelming. The six pieces of wrecked Russian war machines, which they call Kibernitskaya Voyenye Mashina, are scattered across my ranch. I have no doubt that careful forensic analysis of these materials and components will prove conclusively they were manufactured in Russia, and nowhere else.
For a moment, a bit of mischievous humor peeked out through his serious expression.
And if that's not enough to convince the president and her people of the boneheaded mistakes they've made all the way through this crisis, well then, maybe interrogating the prisoners we captured here tonight will do the trick.
He looked straight into the cameras.
But whatever President Barbeau does or doesn't do, the evil men responsible for orchestrating these brutal and unprovoked attacks on our country had better get one thing straight. If I win the election in November and become president of the United States, there will be a day of reckoning. And that's not a threat. It's a solemn promise.
Gennady Grislov snapped off the broadcast with a decisive gesture. Slowly he swiveled to face Kuraykin.
I am shocked, General, he said coldly, shocked to the depths of my soul by these terrible events.
Kuraykin stared at him.
Mr. President, let me remind you that the attempt to kill Governor Farrell was ordered against my best advice. From the beginning, I was the one who warned you that doing so was both hasty and reckless.
Grislov raised an eyebrow.
You misunderstand me, Vladimir,
he said with a sly smile. Seeing the other man's incomprehension, he sighed.
I'm simply expressing my dismay at learning about the crimes you and these other disgraced ex-Russian soldiers have been committing on foreign soil. I can't imagine how you were able to steal so much valuable state property, like those experimental industrial robots, let alone use it to carry out wholly unauthorized terrorist actions against the United States.
He shook his head gravely.
I suspect I'm going to have to clean house at the Ministry of Defense, purging it from top to bottom.
Kuraykin turned pale.
But I... You thought I would sanction what you've done, especially after this fiasco? You forget the core of plausible deniability is the willingness to deny.
He tapped a button on his desk phone. The door to his office swung open. Several hard-faced men in police uniforms filed in. One of them with the two stars of a lieutenant colonel on his shoulder boards moved directly to Kuraykin and laid a firm hand on his shoulder.
Former Major General Vladimir Krykin, by order of the President, I'm placing you under arrest for crimes against the state.
Krykin sat rooted in genuine shock. His mouth opened and closed uselessly, like a fish gasping for breath after it had been hooked and reeled in. The officer who'd arrested him nodded to his subordinates. Silently they closed in, dragged Krykin to his feet, and then led him unresistingly out of the office.
Gryzlov stopped their leader with a glance.
A moment, Colonel.
Sir.
Major General Krykin is a very dangerous man,
Gryzlov said mildly. The lieutenant colonel nodded.
Yes, Mr. President.
So he may try to escape,
Gryzlov went on.
That is possible,
the hard-faced man agreed. Gryzlov's eyes were icy.
Be sure that he makes the attempt.
His smile looked as though it had been pasted on.
Do we fully understand each other?
Completely, Mr. President,
the officer assured him. He saluted and left. Russia's president sat back with a hooded expression. Snipping off loose ends like Krykin was easy. Arriving at a final solution for dangerous men like McClanahan and Farrell and their master Martindale was going to take a great deal more work. The White House, Washington, D.C. Several days later. President Stacy Ann Barbeau glared at the image of her Russian counterpart, Gennady Gryzlov. Over their secure video link, he seemed utterly unfazed by her undisguised anger. In fact, if anything, she realized with mounting fury, he looked remarkably pleased with himself.
"You look unwell, Madam President," he said coolly, before she could start in on him. "Have you consulted your doctors?"
Barbeau felt her teeth grind together. Of course she looked unwell, she thought bitterly. No amount of makeup could disguise the bags under her eyes or the haggard, haunted expression she wore almost constantly these days. With the revelation that the Russians were really responsible for terrorist attacks she'd so vehemently blamed on the Poles and their Iron Wolf Squadron allies, her days in power were numbered. Every Pole, every focus group, every high-priced consultant's report came to the same inexorable conclusion. Politically, she was a dead woman walking. She was going to lose the November election. The only open question right now was by how wide a margin, and how many congressmen and senators of her own party should she take down with her.
"I'm just fine," she lied, "which is more than anyone will be able to say for you in the not-so-distant future, you arrogant son of a bitch."
Gryzlov raised an eyebrow challengingly.
"Is that a threat, Madam President?"
"What else would it be?"
Barbeau snapped.
"What the hell made you think you could launch a covert war against the United States and stroll away unscathed?"
"Me,"
he said with a cold, dismissive laugh.
"Have you forgotten the precedents you set yourself? Long ago you washed your hands of any responsibility for the actions of Cyan's Iron Wolf mercenaries, remember? You practically got down on your knees and begged me to absolve you of their sins against my country. And I agreed,"
he smiled thinly.
"Why then should I take any blame for the actions of a few criminal ex-soldiers who acted without any authorization from my government?"
For a moment, Barbeau could only stare at Gryzlov, flabbergasted by his sheer gall.
"You can't seriously believe anyone will believe that crock of shit,"
she demanded at last.
"Who are you going to claim paid this General Krykin and his man? The Chinese? Some criminal syndicate? Little green men from Mars?"
Gryzlov shrugged his shoulders.
"Who knows? Life is full of mysteries."
His gaze turned even colder.
"In one way, at least, Madam President, my government has proved itself more cognizant of its obligations under international law than yours. You claimed to be powerless against the depredations of Martindale's Scion. Russia is not so weak or negligent. The deaths of the criminal Krykin and his closest associates prove that."
He showed his teeth.
"So you see, justice in my country is swift and certain.
Knocking a few pawns off the board won't cut it this time,
Barbeau retorted.
Will it not?
Grislov said lazily. Abruptly, he leaned forward.
Don't waste any more of my time with paper threats, Madam President. We both know you don't have the stomach for real war. And if you did, who will follow you into the abyss? You have no allies, no friends. Your own Congress will impeach you, if only to save its own skin.
Barbeau saw red for a moment. Oh, for a knife and just a couple of minutes alone with this bastard, she thought darkly, clenching her fists below her desk. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw Luke Cohen starting to get up from his chair. Impatiently, she waved him back down. At last, she breathed out, regaining a small measure of self-control.
You really think you've won something here, Gennady?
She retorted.
Because from where I'm sitting, you look like a loser.
He only smiled.
You think I'm wrong?
Barbeau continued cuttingly.
Well, I hope you enjoy reaping what you've just sowed. Come January, you're going to face a new American president. Someone who's openly hostile to you and your ambitions. A president allied with Martindale and Skymasters, and,
she swallowed a curse, with McClanahan. For the first time, she saw Grislov look uneasy.
I do not fear any of them, he said quickly.
Then you're a moron, she said flatly, because you damned well should be afraid.
Before he could reply, she broke the connection and sat back, breathing hard. Finally, Barbeau turned to Cohen and Roch. Both men had been listening in on the call.
Did you hear Grislov gloating? There's no doubt about it. That son of a bitch is guilty as hell.
And free as a bird, Roch pointed out bluntly, because he's right. Unless we're willing to declare war over this, there's not much we can do, at least in the short term.
Barbeau snorted.
The short term is all I've got, Dr. Roch.
True enough, he agreed. Fortunately, this nation's long-term interests and security don't depend on any single person, most especially not on you.
Her eyes narrowed.
I'm not sure I like your tone very much, Ed.
She scowled at him.
I suggest you leave the half-assed political commentary at the door next time.
There won't be a next time, Madam President, Roch said calmly.
He stood up, pulled a letter from his jacket pocket, and put it on her desk. Barbeau stared down at it.
What the hell is that?
My resignation, he said. Effective immediately.
She looked at him with cold contempt.
So you're just another rat leaving the sinking ship, Dr. Roch?
No, Madam President, Roch replied with equal contempt. In this case, the only rats here are the ones who are staying.
Then, without another word, he turned and walked out of the Oval Office, leaving Stacy and Barbeau speechless behind him. Epilogue. Yelitkowo Beach, on the Baltic coast, near Gdańsk, Poland. Winter 2021. Major Nadia Rozek loped along the wide, windswept stretch of sandy beach. She gritted her teeth against the icy cold, dug into the loose sand, and kept going, striving to master her new prosthetic running blades. They were the last piece of the challenge she'd been wrestling with ever since the surgeons at Fort Sam Hood amputated both of her mangled legs below the knee. Weeks of agonizing hospitalization in the United States had been followed by months of painful and exhausting rehabilitation at home in Poland. She'd already relearned to walk using other, more conventional prosthetic legs. Now she was determined to prove that she was not a helpless cripple to be thanked for her service, awarded a pension, and then gently set aside. Men like Douglas Bader, the World War II RAF fighter ace, had already shown that double amputees could fly and fight in the air. Her task was to convince her superiors that she was fit to serve, even without her legs, as an active duty officer in Poland's special forces. And so every day, in all kinds of weather, she ran up and down this long, empty stretch of beach, rebuilding her strength, her stamina, her agility, and her speed,
Already she was beating the personal records she'd set with two real legs. But she always ran alone. Nadia ducked her head and spit it across the sand, trying to focus on what was just in front of her, and not what might lie in her future. Since she was a child, she'd only ever been afraid of one thing, the chance that she might live out her life as a solitary being, alone and loveless. For years, the comradeship of her fellow soldiers had filled the void, though only imperfectly. Then she'd met Brad McClanahan, and it was as though a new sun had risen in her world, bringing with it a glorious feeling of warmth and growth and joy. But now, when he looked at her, would he still see the woman he loved? Or would Brad's eyes be continually tormented by the sight of her scars and missing limbs? He blamed himself for the wounds she'd taken in that final battle, as unfair as that was. During his visits to her hospital room, and then later in the rehabilitation center, his feelings of guilt and regret had lain between them like the black shadow of the moon as it eclipsed the sun. If only he'd been free to spend more time with her, learning to cope with what had happened, just as she had. But he was a serving soldier in the Iron Wolf Squadron, and his time was not fully his own, especially in a world reeling from the aftermath of Grislav's most recent vicious schemes. Right now, Nadia feared she might lose him forever. America's newly inaugurated President Farrell had lifted all of Barbeau's sanctions and threats of prosecution against those who'd served with Iron Wolf and Cyan. She'd heard the joy in Brad's voice when he phoned her with the news that he and his father were flying back to the United States to visit with family. Weeks had passed since they'd left, with only an occasional awkward call or email or text. What if Brad decided to stay in the land of his birth, rather than return to Poland? Through all their time together, she'd known in her heart that he'd never fully reconciled himself to the possibility of a life spent in exile. She knew she was just feeling sorry for herself, that as a member of the military, she should expect to make sacrifices. After all, Wack Makehomer was going through his own rehabilitation, in his case for several shattered ribs and badly broken arms and legs. He hadn't suffered any amputations, but the big man joked that he had more pins in him than there had been in his grandmother's sewing kit. Each time they spoke in the hospital or on the phone, the colonel's encouragement in spite of his own injuries had helped her stay motivated. Yet even with her determination to overcome her physical limitations, Nadia felt emotionally raw. She stopped to catch her breath, staring down at the hard-packed sand in front of her blades without seeing anything more than a blur.
"You will survive," she told herself. "Whatever happens."
Steeling herself to push through the next 5 kilometers, Nadia looked up and saw a tall, broad-shouldered figure in the dark rifle-green uniform jacket of the Iron Wolf Squadron. He stood alone on the sand, waiting for her. With new energy, she sprinted toward him and found herself caught up in his arms.
"Hi there," Brad said. "I'm back."
Nadia looked up at him in wonder.
"I was afraid you would go home now that your president makes it possible. Home to America."
Smiling gently, he shook his head. "America, Poland, anywhere in the world. It doesn't really matter to me. My real home is where you are, Nadia Rozhik. Always and forever."
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of The Moscow Offensive by Dale Brown, performed by Ryan Burke. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this program or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number, 1-800-222-3225, or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan, 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.